the number of the redeemed in the first group, that's in the Revelation 5 group, what we might style the Passover group. Perhaps just to make that particular transparency complete, we'll just put in here the fact that this lot is Passover. This lot is first fruits. And this lot is tabernacles. Now, another interesting comparison here is that the number of the redeemed in what we will call the Passover group, that is the Revelation 4, 5 and 6 vision, they are styled in verse 11 of Revelation chapter 5, I beheld, and I heard the voice of many angels round about the throne, and the beasts and the elders, and the number of them was 10,000 times 10,000. So the number of the redeemed was 10 times 10 times thousands. When we come to our next group, the sealed group of the first fruits of Revelation chapter 7, the first 8 verses, we are told that the number of those was 12 times 12 times 1,000. When we come to our third group, which are clothed and represent the Feast of Tabernacles in the Antitype, we are told that no man can number them. So each group is specifically related to some sort of numerical value. The first numerical value is 10 times 10, or 10 squared, if you like. 10 squared times thousands. The second group is 12 squared times thousands. And the third group, no man can number. Now, what does 10 represent? Well, 10 seems to be related to human government. These are people who were saved out of Egypt. These were people who were saved by the blood of the Lamb, and they became the first fruits, and they became part of the true Israel of God. And 12 is the number of divine government, the 12 tribes of Israel, the 12 apostles, the 12 foundations of the temple, and so forth. And so from something which was based on 10 squared, they've been redeemed from that, they are sealed and they become the true Israel, but finally when they are clothed upon with immortality, no man can number them, because they will now be spirit nature in the complete sense of the term. The work will be complete. It will not be based upon any form of either human government or, for that matter, divine government, because when the ingathering is complete, in the fullest sense of the term, God will be all in all. Someone might say, yes, but when the nations come up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles, the work of God is not complete. Oh no, that's true. But even in the kingdom age, as the nations keep the Feast of Tabernacles, it will still only be pointing forward to the fact that whilst they are rejoicing at that time, the greater rejoicing will be at the end of the millennium, of when they might also partake of the antitype of the Feast of Tabernacles in the truest sense. So the ultimate Feast of Tabernacles will be when God is all in all. And naturally, no man can number that group. So you see, there are all these comparisons. If you like to get these three records and put them together, you'll find little things like this. What are they doing? Well, I didn't put some of these things down, but you might like to compare what they were doing. The first group was standing around the throne. The third group are standing before the throne. Is there some difference here? But I've summarised it mainly in this way, that the first group were saved by the blood of the Lamb. They were redeemed, they were baptised into Moses. The second group had now been sealed in the forehead, and the third group, they had palms in their hands and they were rejoicing before Yahweh. Well, I don't think it's very hard now to fit ourselves into this general overall pattern. Certainly we have been redeemed, we have been saved out of Egypt. We have been constituted first fruits unto God, and we have been sealed in the forehead by the word. But the sealing process is still going on. When we come later on to Revelation chapter 14, we're going to come back to this multitude again, and the moral characteristics of this group of people will be spelt out before us. They are only sealed in the forehead to the extent that they manifest in their lives the moral purity of the attributes of the deity. And so they await the time when they will be clothed upon with immortality and have palms in their hands and rejoice before Yahweh. I think that's an appropriate time to just take a break. We finished with that one. Those who want to turn tapes over, they could do so now. And that's if anyone the questions that you've still got, you know, don't be frightened to comment on them afterwards. But I hope that's made it a bit clearer for those who might have needed it to be made a bit clearer, and for those who knew it the first time, well, we hope it served as good revision. Right, well, we're going then specifically now to Revelation chapter 7 verse 9, and we're going to have a look at the details of this numberless multitude. You may like to have your notes close handy. Page 85 is the page we'll be looking at. Much of what we've got here in the notes should by this stage be just revisionary. Alright, verse 9. After these things I beheld, and lo, a great multitude. Well, there it is. There's that key phrase again, and I hope by this stage that everybody's very familiar with this, that every time we see this phrase, it's introducing a new vision. Well, our notes tell us on page 85 that once again, the significant phrase "after these things" occurs, indicating a new aspect of the divine revelation. It's not so much the time lapse between the two visions which is important, as the different characteristics of the great multitude. I think we've made it very clear that it's the same group of people, the saints, that are there in the first 8 verses, and it's the saints that are there from verse 9 onwards. Certainly there is a time difference, there is no doubt a time difference, but that's not the main feature. The different characteristics are related to more than just a time factor. Brother Thomas states, the word clothed, see the word clothed there in verse 9, that they are clothed with white robes, he says this is in the perfect participle passive, which means having been clothed. You see his translation up the top there, top of the comment. They stood before the Lamb having been clothed. Now in the Authorised Version it just says he saw a multitude clothed. Brother Thomas says it's not clothed, it's having been clothed, which is the perfect participle passive. Which, if that means something to you, good. If it doesn't mean something to you, it doesn't matter. Brother Thomas simply says that it should be translated having been clothed. In other words, it's something that's passed. Now he goes on to explain his reason for making this statement. This shows that when they shall be seen, in fact, in this palm-bearing attitude, they will have been raised to the divine nature as Christ now is. In other words, it is after the fact that they have been clothed upon with their house which is from heaven, clothed upon with immortality. They will have been raised to the divine nature as Christ now is. This is the pure, incorruptible, and spotless white robe which they receive who, in a doctrinal and moral sense, have in the present state washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. So whilst we now wash our robes and make them white in the blood of the Lamb, and whilst we put on Christ as a garment, this is only a foreshadowing of a greater clothing which is to come when we are clothed upon with immortality. So he points out that even now they may have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb, but that in no way represents the complete clothing as shown here in verse 9. The scene is after the advent and after the resurrection. And furthermore, it belongs to the epoch when the resurrected shall celebrate their first Feast of Tabernacles. This is indicated by their having palms in their hands, for palm bearing belongs to the celebration of that festival in type and in antitype. Well, there's nothing new there, that's only summarising what we've been taking most of the night to say. The Feast of Tabernacles had a wider signification than a mere memorial to the past. It was emblematical of things to come in relation to Israel and the nations of the earth. It is connected with the ingathering of Ephraim, or the 10 tribes, to their land, where alone the feast can be lawfully celebrated. Just pause there to explain briefly what he means by that. Most, I'm sure, are familiar, at least in broad terms, with the work of the regathering of Israel after Christ is in the earth. Zechariah tells us that the Jewish people who are in the land at the time of Armageddon are constituted Judah. But after Armageddon, when Elijah goes forth to regather the remaining Jewish people, they are styled the 10 tribes, or the tribes of Israel. And so during that 40-year period, which is styled the second Exodus, Elijah, together with the refined third of Judah, or as many of them as are to be allotted to the task, plus some of the saints, will go forth to gather the remaining Jewish people who are styled the 10 tribes. And because Ephraim was the leading one of those 10 tribes, they are sometimes styled Ephraim. They will be regathered back to the land, and it's only when they come back to the land and that the temple is open that the nations can then come up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. So there will be no keeping of the tabernacles until the temple is open. The temple is not open until all Israel has been saved. Consequently, that's what Brother Thomas is saying there. He says, it is connected with the ingathering of Ephraim, or the 10 tribes, to their land, where alone the feast can be lawfully celebrated, because all nations have to come up to Jerusalem to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. And he quotes Hosea chapter 12, verse 9, as proof of this fact. So his reference there to Ephraim points out that the Feast of Tabernacles will not be kept until after the Lord has been in the earth some 50 years. Say the first Jubilee has been completed. It also depicts the time when all nations shall come up yearly to Jerusalem to keep the feast and to honour the king enthroned there. Zechariah 14 verse 16 we've already looked at. The great national celebration of the Feast of Tabernacles occurs after the judgment and when the saints are resting from their labours. Now that phrase, resting from their labours, is an allusion to a future chapter in Revelation, which is chapter 14, which deals with the same group. It is significant to note that there will be no festive rejoicings while the events symbolised in Revelation 14 are in progress, and therefore significantly the redeemed multitude are still revealed as the 144,000 being the first fruits unto God and unto the Lamb. I don't want to digress onto Revelation 14, but in order just to clear that point, turn over to Revelation chapter 14. Revelation chapter 14 shows the Lord Jesus Christ in verse 1 standing on Mount Zion. So the Lord is in the earth, the resurrection and the judgment has taken place, Gog has been overthrown, and the Lord Jesus Christ is enthroned in Zion. But Rome has not yet been destroyed. That doesn't come until you get to verse 8. The nations of Europe have not been humbled. Consequently, the second Exodus hasn't taken place. In other words, there are still some works of judgment to be poured out by the saints. Consequently, even though they have been raised from the dead, even though they have been granted immortality, and even though they are now standing with the Lamb on Mount Zion, they are still the 144,000. They're not the numberless multitude yet. Now, we want to stop there. Even a couple of minutes silence wouldn't hurt. to absorb that point, because maybe up to this stage you've thought, oh yeah, I've got it clear. He's talking a lot about God manifestation, that sort of thing, but all he's trying to say is that the saints now are the 144,000, but in the kingdom they'll be the numberless multitude. No, that wasn't what I was saying. And in case you thought you could simplify it by coming to that conclusion, well, you weren't quite correct at all. The 144,000 represents those who are sealed. It can represent the saints now, but it can also represent the saints in immortality up to the time that they are ready to rejoice with the ingathering. And that doesn't happen until after Israel has been gathered into the land, and in the first sense, then the nations can come up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. That's when, in the terms of Revelation, they become the numberless multitude. Now, I'll perhaps repeat that again, because to understand that, we've got to get our thinking caps on in the terms of manifestation. I know you get sick of me saying the theme is God manifestation, but I know that there is a lot of people simply mouth it and don't really acknowledge it. You try to define everything in time brackets. And it's not time brackets at all. It's theme brackets. The 144,000 represent those who are sealed either in the mortal or immortal state. The numberless multitude represent the saints rejoicing before Yahweh in the keeping of the Feast of Tabernacles. So here in Revelation 14 they are now glorified, but they are not yet ready to rejoice until their work has been complete. And you remember in that paragraph we read that I said there was a phrase there which says they rest from their labours? That's in that Revelation chapter 14 in verse 13. Take verses 12 and 13. Here is the patience of the saints. Here are they that keep the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus. And I heard a voice from heaven saying unto me, write, blessed are the dead which die in the Lord from henceforth. Yea, saith the Spirit, that they may rest from their labours, and their works do follow them. That is one of the most favourite verses which are used by clergymen in funerals, but of course they read it quite wrongly. The phrase there, which says, yea, saith the Spirit, that they may rest from their labours and their works do follow them. Brother Thomas points out that the phrase from henceforth means from this time forth, that is, as far as in the kingdom is concerned. It is after the judgments on Babylon, after Europe has been humbled. Now, he says, from henceforth, from this time on, the saints may rest from their labours, and their works he goeth in aid of with them, says Brother Thomas, which we'll deal with when we come to Revelation 14. But the time when they rest from their labours is from henceforth. That is after the work of the judgments of Revelation 14. That's when they will then become the numberless multitude. So there's still the 144,000 in the terms of the themes of Revelation, even after they're glorified. Now, I can only keep repeating the same sort of statements over and over again. But I hope by this stage that you are starting to get the general theme of Revelation and realise that we are not looking at chronological or time divisions. We're looking at various facets of the way in which God will reveal himself through the same multitude of people in different aspects of their work. Okay, back to our notes on page 86. From these considerations, it is possible to see that this seventh chapter of the Apocalypse presents two great epochs with a long intervening period of tribulation extending from the one to the other. We use the word tribulation because it says there that this is a multitude which has been redeemed out of great tribulation. The first is the epoch of the sealing of the 144,000. Being the first fruits unto God and to the Lamb. And the last, the epoch of the festive celebration of the ingathering of the world's fruit unto Yahweh Elohim, answering to the joyful observance of the Feast of Tabernacles. The interval between the sealing epoch in the 4th century and the festive celebration just described is long. The sealing has continued in all subsequent generations, and will continue until the Ancient of Days comes, when the door will be shut, and entrance into his presence as a glorified constituent of the royal name will be denied to other applicants. In this chapter, John exhibits only the initial and terminal epochs. So whilst Brother Thomas acknowledged that the sealing would go on down through the generations, in Revelation chapter 7 he shows the beginning of it, coming at this particular period here in the 4th century. And you know my version of this, I'm not placing a lot of emphasis on the fact that it did take place in the 4th century. I think this is secondary to our main consideration, but this is a quote from Eureka that I'm reading here at the moment. He says, John only looks at these two terminal epochs. He sees the sealing in the 4th century, and he sees the numberless multitude with the palms in their hands in the kingdom. He says in this chapter, John exhibits only the initial and terminal epoch, the beginning and the end. The sealing and the palm bearing are two tiers from which spring an ional arch. That's very graphic language. He says there's two tiers. You put an arch over the top of it and it spans the ages, because that's what the word ional means. So he says from the beginning of the sealing right to the Feast of Tabernacles, that is spanned by an arch which bridges over. And now he links together all of these visions which are going to come out in this section in Revelation. It spans over the times of the trumpets, the vials, the seven thunders, and consequently spans the aeon of the woman in the wilderness, the partly contemporary aeons of the two witnesses, the beast of the sea, the beast of the earth, the imperial image, and the aeon of the judgment of the scarlet coloured beast and its drunken ecclesiastical rider. That statement, in general terms, may help to explain to you why all of that section from chapter 7 to chapter 15 verse 4 is part of one vision. Because this palm-bearing multitude here span the period from there to there, and it incorporates all of these things here, which are the events of that period. So he says it simply jumps from one to the other and spans that particular period of time. Well, I don't really think that paragraph has really said much more than what we've been saying previously, except it might have just said it in language a little bit harder to understand. But as with all of Brother Thomas's material, he certainly does condense it, and he picks just the right word for the right place. We come then to verse 10 of Revelation chapter 7. And in verse 10 we are told, as Brother Thomas translates it, and vociferating with a loud voice, is a good word, vociferating with a loud voice, saying, the salvation be ascribed to him who sits upon the throne of our deity and to the Lamb. Notice the words be ascribed have been put in there. That's been put in to make the sense. Brother Thomas put it in. But if you read the authorized version, you've got this multitude saying, salvation to our God. Well, they're not exactly going to ascribe salvation to God, but let's start that again. They're not going to say that God has now obtained salvation, but that the salvation which they have obtained was ascribed to the one who sits on the throne of the deity and to the Lamb. So you might like to note Brother Thomas's translation there, which is a better one than what we've got there in the AV. So separating with a loud voice, you can probably use crying if you like, with a loud voice saying, the salvation be ascribed to him who sits upon the throne of our deity and to the Lamb. You'll notice he's also just altered that matter about the throne. With the AV says, salvation to our God which sitteth upon the throne. Whereas he says, salvation be ascribed to him who sits upon the throne of our God. Just reworded that a little bit. To which our comments is, the Feast of Tabernacles follows closely upon the great day of atonement, and therefore it is fitting in the context of their rejoicing that they are mindful of the salvation which has been achieved for them by the Lamb which taketh away the sin of the world. In keeping with the theme of God manifestation, it is fitting that the Lord Jesus Christ is depicted in both aspects of his work, namely of that of God manifest in the flesh and now in spirit, sitting upon the throne, and also as the Lamb, indicating the means by which the great multitude were enabled to assemble with him as a glorified community. You know, despite the fact that you might know I'm having trouble with Revelation, you really have learned a lot since you started this, because you see that phrase, the Lamb there, you know, 15 months ago, you would have assumed that whenever you read about the Lord Jesus Christ as the Lamb, that spoke of his work at his first advent, and the Lion was the second advent. Now, I think you've all unlearnt that by now, haven't you? And you've got that idea out of your mind. You see, here he is, still described as the Lamb, and he's in company with a numberless multitude, and he's still the Lamb. Because as they rejoice, their mind goes back to the means which brought them there, and they now see him on the throne as the manifestation of deity. Their very rejoicing is not just because of the fact that he is enthroned, but because they are there with him. Therefore they see him in two aspects. They see him as the one sitting upon the throne, they see him as the Lamb. One man in two aspects of his work. Not time setting. You don't make the Lamb the Lord Jesus Christ at his first advent and the Lion 2,000 years later. In general terms there's some truth in that. Some truth in it. But just enough error to get you into a lot of strife if you apply that rule rigidly in all cases. So here he is, celebrating the Feast of Tabernacles in antitype and still described as the Lamb. Verses 11 and 12. All the angels stood in the circle of the throne and of the elders and of the four living ones. And they fell before the throne upon their face, and did homage to the deity, saying, "So let it be, the blessing and the glory and the wisdom and the thanksgiving and the honour and the power and the majesty be to our deity for the cycles of the cycles, so let it be." Brother Thomas, again, we quote on this particular section, says that these palm-bearing Elohim are the goodly trees, the palm trees, the fig trees, and the willows of the brook, the trees of righteousness, whose leaves are unfading, the planting of Yahweh on either side of the pure river of water of life, clear as crystal, the great forest of evergreens, filling the earth with their perfume to the glory of his name. In Eureka, there's only a very small section which he devotes to this particular portion, Revelation 7, 9 to 17. In fact, it's only about 4 pages, barely 4 pages, which is particularly small. But he does speak in a very beautiful fashion about these palm-bearing Elohim. Carrying on from that quote which I've just taken, he goes on to say, and this is right at the, I'm quoting from the Red edition in this case, it's the very last couple of pages of volume 2A. He says, "But before they could figure as stately palm trees in the concourse of nations, they had to drink of the brook by the way." You see this allusion here about these trees, fig trees, palm trees, willows of the brook. This is taken from Leviticus 23 that we read this evening. Now he says, before they could be like that, they also had to drink of the brook by the way. In this relation of things, they were willows of the brook. And this is the reason why afterwards they exalt their heads above the peoples in this great feast of tabernacles as lofty palms. The captain of their salvation, who leads them to glory, was himself once a willow of the brook, a weeping willow, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. As the Christ Spirit in David predicted in Psalm 110 verse 7 concerning David's son and Lord, so it was verified in Jesus. He drank of the brook by the way, therefore he shall exalt the head. He was obedient unto death, therefore he was crowned with glory and honour. But in the scene before us, though like their chief, they had been willows of the brook. John did not see them bearing willow boughs. He saw them only with palms in their hands. Had he seen willows in their hands instead of palms, it would have indicated that they were still a suffering community. That they had been a community of sufferers in a former state is certain by the question put to John and answered by the elder. He asked John who the palm bearers were and whence they came, to which John replied, "Sire, thou hast known." He knew experimentally, for he was one of them, inasmuch as the elders and the living ones are representatives of the whole company of the redeemed. "These are they," said he, "who came out of great tribulation and washed their robes and made their robes white in the blood of the Lamb, out of the great tribulation which precedes their resurrection from the dead. And because they held fast the name of the faith and defiled not their garments and were faithful unto death, therefore they are before the throne of the Deity and serve him day and night in his temple." He goes on to say a few more words about their characteristics. But the one main feature that he's bringing out is this, that in our present state, we are the willows of the brook. And the willow feeds quite insatiably on water. It feeds on the water of life. And these willows represent now the saints who, in preparation for their time in the age to come when they shall celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles, might be the stately tree, otherwise styled the Cedars of Lebanon, or these trees which he's speaking about here. But he points out that during this present period, which is a period of tribulation, the grounds for success will be that they have put down their roots deeply into that ground, which is right by that brook, and they can feed on the water of life. It's the same expectation which we come back to, that it's only in proportion to the extent that we partake of that life-giving water that we can, of course, prepare ourselves for the kingdom to come. Consequently, then, the chapter concludes on this particular note, verses 13 to 17, and we'll read the Doctor's translation. "And one from among the elders who was speaking, saying to me, 'These who have been clothed with white robes, who are they and whence came they?' And I answered him, 'Sire, thou hast known.' And he said to me, 'These are they who came out of the great tribulation, washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. On account of this, they are before the throne of the Deity, and they shall minister to him day and night in his temple, and he that is sitting upon the throne shall pitch his tent over them. They shall hunger no more, neither shall they thirst any more, neither shall the sun smite them, nor any heat, because the Lamb in the very midst of the throne shall tend them and lead them to living fountains of waters, and the Deity shall wipe away every tear from their eyes." There he took wrong the word bush. During the sealing period, the saints suffered persecution, whether as a result of the treatment they received from the authority or the tribulation they suffered in the perilous times of prosperity, 2 Timothy 3. They had heeded the Lord's message to the ecclesiastes, and because they had overcome, had been granted to sit with him in his throne. This is indicated by the symbol that they had washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb, or as expressed in the letter to Sardis, they had not defiled their garments, for they are worthy. The final verses of this chapter are very reminiscent of the Feast of Tabernacles, inasmuch as we have a picture of the Lord sitting on the throne and dwelling among them. This glorious vision is considered by John in greater detail in Revelation 21 and 22. Well, that having been completed, John then takes on a new phase of this same vision, and God willing, in our next few classes, we're then going to have a look at the sounding of the seven trumpets. and we're going to see some of the events which are part of this great Ionian arch, as Brother Thomas describes it, that spans the period of the initial sealing of the saints right down to their final celebration. Surely, though, these verses that we've considered tonight, verses 9 to 17, should move us very greatly to consider the nearness of the coming of the Lord Jesus Christ. Very easy, of course, in all of our studies to treat these things purely academically. We can even go further than that, and we can do as we've done this evening, and we can draw types and anti-types. But if, brethren and sisters, we are unable, in our own simple little way, to simply say, this is a vision of the kingdom, this multitude, 10,000 times 10,000, or 12,000 squared, or a numberless multitude, or whatever the case might be, if we can't see that as representative of our skill, rejoicing because of what the Lord has done for us, then of course we're really not getting anything out of our studies at all. The news over the last few weeks has shown to us that we're certainly in the time of trouble. Nation after nation is being troubled with the, as the time of the end comes on, and it seems that Australia is one of those few places that can still live in the proverbial fool's paradox. Whether or not we do have to suffer like some of these nations, it doesn't matter. The fact is that there is a positive vision of the kingdom here. And surely each one of us should go away from here this evening, realising that there's nothing that this country or that this life can offer us in comparison with the vision of the kingdom to come. And so might we then go away with a prayer on our lips, as the Apostle John did when he concluded the book of Revelation, even so come Lord Jesus.
Hymn 137.